Hello, and welcome to Not Shallow, the podcast. I'm Rebecca Collins, and I want to thank you so much for tuning in to this episode. It's a very special episode. We're dedicating it to one topic here today. It's really hot out today here in Minnesota. Hot, 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 as Buster Poindexter would say. And now I'm trying to not Google Buster Poindexter and find out what the hell happened to that guy. But I'm going to refrain from doing that so that I can talk to you about lifestyles of the rich and famous. The TV show, maybe you know about it, maybe not, because it aired from 1984 to 1995. Perhaps that was before your time, as people like to say, but it was of my time. And it was a spinoff of another beloved show, Entertainment Tonight, made by the same guy who created shows like Star Search and Solid Gold. Basically, this one guy, Al Mascini, was responsible for a treasure trove of TV goodness. The host of Lifestyles, I always call it Lifestyles, it's like my own little abbreviation. The host was Robin Leach, and he is a Brit with this very distinctive voice. And he was working for Entertainment Tonight, but then he jockeyed to host this new show that promised to be the first of its kind to delve deeper into the lavish lifestyles of celebrities in a way that Entertainment Tonight wasn't able to do because, you know, limited time and just so much celebrity news to cover. Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous was quintessentially 80s in the way that it just celebrated over-the-top wealth. It was a syndicated show, and it seemed to air, at least when I was growing up, late on weekend afternoons, maybe like early evenings. I recall Saturday nights when I would, you know, be eating a Tombstone pizza fresh from the oven, and I would watch B-list celebrities on Lifestyles cavort in their jacuzzis or walk the beach in the Bahamas or talk to us about their obsession with cars. And I enjoyed the spectacle, but what teenager growing up on a farm wouldn't like a glimpse inside a stretch limo? After it was over, I would stay put for other syndicated fare, like the aforementioned Solid Gold, which was a favorite, Star Search, another favorite, Dance Fever, Putting on the Hits, which was a lip-syncing show. Recently, I started to wonder about Lifestyles and the people it profiled. What happened to them all? So I went out on YouTube and searched for snippets of old episodes, and I had to endure a lot of terrible videos. So it was the kind of video where someone had their TV on and they were playing Lifestyles, or, you know, they had it tuned to Lifestyles, and they set a camcorder in front of the TV. So they're recording the TV, not recording from the TV. Or there were a lot of recordings that just had the commercials in them. So you were fast forwarding through these commercials as you tried to watch your Lifestyles episode. A lot of the episodes, unfortunately, though, are just lost to time. I wasn't able to find a lot of the celebrities that I wanted to see. But what I did find was pretty strange. There was a segment that was kind of reminiscent of the tea party scene in Alice in Wonderland with pro wrestler Randy Macho Man Savage and Sherry Martel and Robin Leach playing croquet on what I took to be Randy's estate. He's cavorting in his neon tights and green knee-high boots and his sunglasses and his hat. So, you know, the full Monty there. And Robin Leach is wearing these baggy chinos that, you know, they're actually worse than what Randy has on because they are so baggy in front that they look like he just found somebody's leftover maternity pants and put them on. And then someone else, I think I have it identified as this guy named Claude Giroux, who performed in wrestling as Macho Midget, which is a very classy name. He was acting at one point as a human wicket for them. So he's bent over and they're shooting the ball, you know, through him. So that's pretty strange. Just a side note that Randy Savage died in 2011 at age 58 of a sudden heart attack while driving. And Sherry Martel is also passed on. She died in 2007 of a drug overdose. I found a long, excruciating segment about the supermodels of the 90s. I think I was done hearing about them in the 90s. And there was, you know, this talk with a very fresh-faced Naomi Campbell, not the kind of plastic tired face that she has now. And she was very excited about her forthcoming novel. And there was a segment from 1987 with David Hasselhoff telling us all about his new career as rock idol in Germany and Austria. And they had clips of him singing Born to be Wild while wearing this headband during his Whistle Stop European tour. And then there was a scene of him wandering around his home recording studio, supposedly writing a song, but actually just looking really bored and restless and kind of like, when will this be over? And I can just go in my kitchen and just eat some Cheese Whiz and crackers. And then there was a segment about New Kids on the Block on tour. And the naughtiest thing I think they're shown doing is just eating some very fatty snacks in the tour bus after the concert. So in this episode, what I'm going to do is take a more in-depth look at two of the more fascinating, well-known, celebrated celebs I was able to find profiles of, their lifestyles profiles online. First, we've got some good vibrations with Mike Love of the Beach Boys. And then we are going to do a little Dr. Feelgood with Vince Neil. So let's get on with our champagne wishes and caviar dreams. Here's what Mike Love of the Beach Boys has to say near the beginning of his Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous profile.
I have lived a nice, upstanding lifestyle, I think, you know, no drugs and no alcoholism in my, you know, closet of life. I mean, some of my cousins, Dennis, the most unfortunate, died basically as a result of his alcoholism and drug abuse. And then my cousin Brian, of course, is world famous for his mental ups and downs. But that is their problem. Those were their problems. That's their lifestyle.
I wasn't aware that mental illness is a lifestyle choice. I guess in Mike Love's world, manic depression and something like vegetarianism or being a nudist are apparently on the same level. It's not clear where Love is speaking from in his interview, but it might be his hilltop hideaway in Lake Tahoe, California. Hilltop hideaway is the kind of phrase that Robin Leach loves, along with phrases like bombshell beauty, glittering galaxy of superstars, and the chic with the freak, the old guard with the avant-garde. Leach informs us in this segment that we can rent Love's Tahoe residence for $1,000 a night. So remember, that's $1,000 a night in 1990 money, which makes you wonder if Love is really doing okay, or if this is just all a ploy to get some renters lined up in the pre-Airbnb era. Love says, "I love furniture and cutlery and art and all that kind of stuff, but I've never collected any of it because I'm always bounding around from home to home and tour to tour." It's sad to me that Mike Love was never able to indulge something as simple and yet as specific as his love for cutlery. Maybe if he had a large collection of steak knives to play with, he would stop suing his relatives. We're then taken to another Love residence, his estate in Santa Barbara, where he recently hosted the Maharishi Festival, which Leach describes as a music and meditation-filled lovin'. I guess no pun intended. Leach explains that Love credits Eastern philosophy with showing him good vibrations and that he's a regular practitioner of transcendental meditation. Before you can even fully take this in, you're whisked off to another estate, a third estate, this one in Maui, where Love is shown performing a self-administered massage, which mostly amounts to him rubbing his white chicken legs, his thighs, while explaining that he's getting rid of the cooties, which is his word for toxins, and also reversing the aging process. He goes on to say that the most important thing about any home environment is its restorative properties. And then I can't help but stop and think about his cousin, Brian Wilson, who famously spent what amounted to maybe 2 years lying in bed. I don't think home was necessarily a restorative place for him. All this meditation, restorative practice, and massage must have prepared Love not to be less judgmental or more in the moment, but maybe it girded him for his upcoming legal battles with the band that made his fortune and all those estates possible in the first place. Without the Beach Boys, Mike Love couldn't even contemplate a collection of cutlery. Within the Beach Boys, Brian Wilson, Mike's cousin, has always been considered the musical powerhouse, some say genius. Between 1963 and 1965, he wrote and produced 9 Beach Boys albums and 16 singles, including Pet Sounds. Well, actually, that was 1966. Even as a young adult, though, he had an unstable mind, and his problems only grew worse when he discovered LSD and later cocaine and heroin. If you watch interviews with Wilson, he's the first to admit that he essentially fried his brain. In 1967 or 68, he suffered his first nervous breakdown. He heard voices in his head, and he was unable to work, unable to leave his house. Eventually, he was diagnosed with bipolar schizoaffective disorder, but there were many years lost in between, perhaps 15, maybe more. And at the middle to tail end of this, he became fell under the spell of a psychologist. I think his name is Eugene Landy. I know the last name is Landy, and that's kind of the subject matter of the new film Love and Mercy, which I've seen and I thought was pretty good. So you might want to check that out. But while Brian Wilson was always trying to push musical boundaries, I think Mike Love really wanted to play it safe and stick with the themes and the music that made the Beach Boys popular in the early 1960s when they first started. So surfing, cars, girls. Throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s, he constantly toured with the Beach Boys, kind of a rotating cast. The youngest Wilson brother acted as a musical director, and Mike took on sort of a leadership role. And he started performing more of his own songs, like Big Sur, Everyone's in Love with You, and Sumahama. Huh? What? Zuma what? What was that? Exactly. No one really knows how much Mike Love ever contributed to writing Beach Boy songs in actuality. He's only really had one tune that you're all probably familiar with, which is Kokomo. And people tend to come down pretty hard on one side of the Kokomo line or another. Either they think it's great or they hate it. I mean, it is one of the worst earworms in history. Once it gets in there, it's really hard to get it out. I guess lots of people do love it. I mean, it was on the Cocktail soundtrack, the Tom Cruise movie Cocktail, in, I think, 88. But Love considers this song to be perhaps his greatest contribution to music, or maybe it's society at large. Here's what he had to say about Kokomo. Who wants to hear about Brian's mental problems anyway? I mean, to call a record Sweet Insanity. Imagine that. A whole album of Brian's madness that no one wants to release and still everyone says he's a genius. I make Kokomo. It goes to number one in the charts and I'm still the dumb, know-nothing, talentless Mike Love. Sounds like someone needs some more self-massage. Maybe to the shoulders to remove that gigantic chip. I put together a brief listing, probably not complete, because I feel like this could be an entire research project, of Love's other shenanigans throughout the years. In 1982, he fired Brian Wilson from the band, despite, of course, the fact that Brian is arguably the real musical talent associated with the band. In 1994, he won a suit that established saying that he has proper authorship credit for 39 Beach Boys songs that he co-wrote. He tried to get credit for 79, but only got 39. He was battling Brian Wilson here for future royalties. And there are threads online about this battle. And, you know, people take sides. You know, who wrote you know, wouldn't it be nice? And they're pretty funny and entertaining to read. That on that wouldn't it be nice, someone said, the wouldn't it be nice question has been answered satisfactorily, in my opinion. Mike contributed the good night, uh-oh baby, sleep tight, uh-oh baby couplet at the end. Not a lot of words, but it could be argued an important hook. Similarly, his contribution to 409 was the hook line, she's real fine, my 409, as well as the backup vocal line, giddy up, 409. Then we have his acceptance speech when the Beach Boys were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. This was actually in 88, a little bit off. My timeline is off. I apologize. But you can watch Mike's cringe fest on YouTube if you feel like it, but suffice it to say that Love takes the mic and proceeds to call out Paul McCartney and Diana Ross for not being at the ceremony, I guess because they were embroiled in lawsuits with their respective bands, which is pretty funny considering what lay ahead for Love and the Beach Boys. And then he calls out the Rolling Stones and the Beatles. He says, the Beach Boys have continued to do about 180 performances a year. I'd like to see the Mop Tops match that. And then he says, I'd like to see Mick Jagger get out on this stage and do I Get Around versus Jumpin' Jack Flash any day now. A lot of confused looks in the audience on that one. And then in 2005, Love sued Brian Wilson again because a British paper, The Mail on Sunday, put a promotional CD, was given free with the paper, to promote Brian Wilson Presents Smile, his own solo album. And Love was upset because, you know, he claimed this was a loss of income, lost income for the Beach Boys, which is a really sad image after all these years. You know, Mike Love is still grubbing around in the dirt for every penny. I guess three estates is not enough. The lawsuit was dismissed in 2007 on the grounds that it was without merit. But then in 2012, after the Beach Boys reunited for their 50th anniversary tour, Love, who legally controls the Beach Boys' name, issued a statement saying that Wilson, original Beach Boy Al Jardine, and longtime member David Marks were out, and that he would soldier on alone, fortified by self-massage, transcendental meditation, Bruce Johnson, and his son, Christian Love, Mike's son, one of them, and a random backup band. And they did just perform in Minnesota over the 4th of July weekend at Mystic Lake Casino in Prior Lake. But, hey, what about Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous? We're way off track here. Well, the latter half of Mike Love's segment is devoted to showcasing his latest live-in lady love, another leech-esque description. Her name is Jackie or Jacqueline Pison. Love admits he's a bit gun-shy after 5 marriages and divorces. She's 25 to his 49, which isn't scandalous, just maybe a little creepy when he says that he met her when she was a contestant in a beauty pageant in Waikiki Beach. Then he says, "I'm very much a ladies' man, I admit. Yes, life in prison as a ladies' man. Just lock me up with a lot of ladies." Yikes. The segment shows Love riding around his Maui estate with 2-year-old son Brian, interesting name choice, explaining how he didn't really have time for his other children, but with the demands of the band and all, but he's really putting his all into it this time. And then I was curious about Love's other relationships, so I consulted Wikipedia, and it turns out he did end up marrying Jackie in 1994, and they're still married, making the 6th time the charm for him. The single sentence about his family life in the entry was odd, however, as it said he has 9 children, 2 with Pison, 6 from his 4 previous marriages, and 1 from another relationship. But Wiki is missing a marriage. Even on Lifestyle, it says Love had 5 wives before Jackie, making her number 6. And also, who is this child from another relationship? Well, it turns out Love had an illegitimate daughter named Sean Marie Harris. And in 1983, his cousin and bandmate, Dennis Wilson, married Sean Marie Harris, making her his 5th wife. But this was after she'd already given birth to their son when she was 19. Opinions differ on how old she was when she gave birth to their son. But either way, it's not looking so great for Dennis Wilson. But it also is not so great for Mike Love, who never claimed her as his daughter. And she died at the age of 35 of cancer. So now I want to share with you the intro Leech gave Mike Love's profile.
In the often rocky world of solid gold pop success, Beach Boy Mike Love is truly a surfing survivor. On the way to becoming a multi-platinum hitmaker, he had to ride some dangerous waves. In an industry awash with heroes and villains, it was rock and roll to the rescue. It meant hanging tough, but Mike told us he emerged squeaky clean.
What was that he said at the end about being squeaky clean? Because I gotta be honest, I'm seeing a very dirty asshole. During research on Mike Love, I quickly became obsessed with the trials and tribulations of the Beach Boys. I found myself poring over an archived article in People magazine from 83 titled "Death of a Beach Boy," about the drowning death of Dennis Wilson. Then I Googled images of Dennis and his one-time girlfriend, Christine McVie of Fleetwood Mac. And then I thought I needed to get a grip. After all, how many people under 40 actually know or care about the Beach Boys? I thought of a good analogy. It's kind of like the Andrews Sisters. Whenever I would hear about the Andrews Sisters, I mean, my eyes just glaze over, and this voice in my head, like a robot voice, kind of just says, "Old group from the 40s, not relevant." But the Andrews Sisters, Laverne, Maxine, and Patricia, were beloved in their time and sold over 75 million records. They were also very wealthy and influenced many, many other artists. Still, today, if you ask people who the Andrews Sisters are, you probably will get a blank stare or maybe a shrug. Someone may mention Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy. But you'd have to do, I feel like you'd have to do a lot of person on the street interviews before you'd find that person. And that person is probably over 40. It's nothing new, though, how the rich and the famous descend to become the has-beens at the fringe of pop culture, serving mainly as answers to trivia questions. But even though it's a tale as old as time, it still captures the imagination. How could someone who had so much promise to have more, which is very tantalizing in our culture, suddenly have so little? And I think that might lead us to Vince Neil of Motley Crue. Here's the dirty secret of lifestyles of the rich and famous, something I didn't understand at the time I was watching it. If you were profiled on the show, chances are your fortunes were wavering. The celebrities featured on Lifestyles were often on the brink of showbiz oblivion, and they knew it. Their publicists and managers knew it. Thus, they agreed to be profiled on a show that would claim the opposite, as if pretending could make it so. If you were a star having a Lifestyles moment in the 80s or early 90s, you weren't really on top. You were already sliding to the bottom. A quick look at celebrities profiled on the show confirms this theory. There's the aforementioned piece about David Hasselhoff barnstorming Germany and his new role as rock star. And then there's Donna Mills, Sean Young, Geraldo Rivera, Sinbad, Richard Marx, New Kids on the Block, Roseanne and Tom Arnold, Jonathan Winters in Alaska, Lauren Hutton on Safari, Dr. Ruth in China, Vanna White and Wink Martindale, Prince Charles. You get the picture. Who better to illustrate then the kind of meteoric rise and precipitous impending fall that would draw the attention of the producers of Lifestyles than Vince Neil, singer for hair metal band Motley Crue? Neil appeared on the show in 1993 after getting dumped by the crew. Leach says axed in typical Leach fashion, and also dumped by wife number two, Charisse Rudell, a mud wrestler and model. The show is upfront about these blows to Neil's ego. I mean, it's not like you can really hide them. But it makes clear within the first 30 seconds that Neil is still enjoying the good life. Speedboats, race cars, and lots of beautiful girls. Neil, looking a bit doughy and with his over-dyed hair lank against the sides of his face, opens his segment with,
"Best day of my life is when I got fired from Motley Crue."
First, we're shown around Neil's multi-million dollar Malibu mansion, complete with ocean view and a pretty big living room. According to him, 55 feet by 45 feet, something like that, trying to sound as if he hadn't taken a tape measure to it. He explains that the house has a lot of electrical gadgets in it, which is, I guess, something special in 1993, and we're treated to a view of an electric shade slowly rising up to cover the view of the beach outside. He tells us the whole house is wired for sound. It has TVs that lift out of the floor and the walls. It's got lots of bedrooms. It's a good party house. The story then cuts to neighbor Pamela Anderson stopping by to toast to fame and fortune with a bottle of champagne. Just 2 years later, Anderson would become Pamela Anderson Lee when she married Tommy Lee, Motley Crue's drummer. They also toast Neil's new line of skimpy swimwear called Exposure Swimwear. Cue the crew hit Girls, Girls, Girls and footage of anonymous swimsuit models showing off Exposure's wares on the Malibu beach. Think lots of slow pans over boobs and butts. Anyway, awkward segue to Neil's love of cars. He explains that he just walks by a dealership and thinks, oh man, I've got to have that, and buys a new car. He says he likes to piss people off, people who've worked their entire lives, by tooling around in his expensive cars, this guy with long hair, tattoos, and puka shells. I personally think just the puka shells alone, hanging from a rearview mirror, is really enough to piss other people off. But perhaps this isn't what's actually pissing people off at all. As the segment veers off into detailing Neil's passion for car and boat racing, with him giving a monotone narration about he lives on the edge, I wonder how many people in the viewing audience knew about his 1984 conviction for vehicular manslaughter and driving under the influence of alcohol. He lost control of his car and hit an oncoming vehicle, and he seriously injured the occupants of the other car, but he killed the passenger in his car, a man named Nicholas Dingley, who was the drummer for the band Hanoi Rocks. And he was sentenced to 30 days in jail, 5 years probation, $2.6 million in restitution to the victims, and 200 hours of community service. He got out of jail in 15 days for good behavior. I mean, I don't know why they couldn't just keep him for 30 days, since that's already a little laughable. But he got out, and then Motley Crue was kind enough to dedicate their third album, Theater of Pain, to Dingley, which I'm sure was a big comfort to him, the dead guy. I mean, that sounds like a fair trade, doesn't it? Your life for, you know, Theater of Pain being dedicated to you? Switching tracks, Robin Leach informs us that since being fired from the crew, Neil has formed the creatively named The Vince Neil Band and unleashed the album Exposed, which seems to be a word that Neil might have an obsession with. Leach claims that the album's success proves that when it comes to fans, rock and roll never forgets. Or does it? The album, which featured songs like Can't Change Me, Fine Fine Wine, and Gettin' Hard, got to number 13 on the charts but failed to earn gold. Ultimately, the same thing would happen to Motley Crue when they released their first album without Neil, maybe because they also tried to change their sound, because they thought they should be more grunge. Neil came out with a second solo album called Carved in Stone in 1995, which sold less than 100,000 copies, and it caused his label Warner Brothers to drop him. This probably also convinced him that it was time to make amends with his former bandmates, and in 1997, the crew and Neil reunited. I wonder if he then said that the day Motley Crue took him back into the band was the new best day of his life. So what was really going on with Neil during and after this puff piece on lifestyles? Well, it turns out he actually stopped racing cars in 1992 after a crash in the third lap during a race in Long Beach, which was way before this interview was taped. And there were a lot of tough times for him ahead, enough material to fill several seasons of a reality show, which he was on a reality show, The Surreal Life. Sadly, in 1995, his daughter, who was featured with Neil in the Lifestyles piece, died of cancer. He had two more wives, divorcing his fourth wife, a fellow cast member on Surreal Life in 2002. Just a fun side note, they were married by MC Hammer. Wikipedia then offers up a laundry list of failed entrepreneurial efforts. I want to give a quick rundown just because I'm quite taken with this. In 1994, he gave up ownership of his Bar One Club. In 1998, Motley Crue opened a store on Melrose in Los Angeles called Screw, which stocked clothes from Nikki Sixx and Neil, their clothing lines called Outlaw and Bad Bones. No mention anywhere whatever happened to this Exposure swimwear line. Anyway, the store closed a year later. In 06, Neil opened his own tattoo parlor called Vince Neil Inc. The shop recently closed. He also founded Vince Vineyards, a winemaking venture. My internet searches were unable to confirm if this is still active. In 2005, he created Off the Strip Poker Tournament in Las Vegas, which no longer seems to be a thing. In 07, he launched his own brand of tequila called Tres Rios. I think this is still a thing. If you really wanted it, you could probably drink Vince Neil's tequila. But why drink that when you could be drinking Sammy Hagar's tequila? So there you go. He opened Dr. Feelgood's Bar and Grill in West Palm Beach, and then another one in 09 in Miami Beach. And he owns a Feelgood's in Las Vegas, but it doesn't really look like any of these are actually open. I think they all closed. There is a Dr. Feelgood's in Aloha, Oregon, but I have a feeling there is no relation. In 2012, he ventured into the gentlemen's club business. Seems like a natural. Opening Deja Vu Presents Vince Neil's Girls, Girls, Girls in Las Vegas. According to Yelp, this is closed. And in 2014, he became a minority owner in the Jacksonville Sharks arena football team, and he's the current owner of the Las Vegas Outlaws, another arena football league team. He released his third solo album, Tattoos and Tequila, in 2010. The album is a soundtrack to go with his memoir of the same name, Tattoos and Tequila, To Hell and Back, with one of rock's most notorious frontmen. I haven't read the book yet, but it sounds like it could be a barn burner, possibly including details of his arrest in 2002 for punching record producer Michael Schumann, and 2003 after accusations he assaulted a sex worker at the Moonlight Bunny Ranch, 2004 arrest warrant for misdemeanor assault after a fight during a show where he knocked a sound technician unconscious, and his 2007 arrest for suspicion of DUI in Las Vegas after police saw him making erratic moves in his Ferrari, pissing everybody off, and probably just tossing strings of puka shells out the window. He got a deal on that last one, and then he was arrested again. In 2011, pled guilty to drunk driving. 2011, charged with battery and disorderly conduct. Oh, hey, what about lifestyles of the rich and famous, huh? Isn't this what it's all about? Neil ended his piece by saying that all he really wants to do back in 93 was put out his music. It's all about the music. It's all about the music, man. And then he looks off camera with a very vacant stare. Wow, who knew just how dirty the closets of the formerly rich and famous could be? Luckily, I have something fun to leave you with. In all my searching, I also came across two segments of Lifestyles that featured soap opera star Jackie Zeman. I believe she's best known for her role playing Bobby on General Hospital. In the first one, it's 1985, and Jackie is newly married to a realtor named Steve. His last name is not important. He describes how he fell in love with her the moment they shook hands. She says it took her longer to fall in love with him. It took 3 hours. By the third date, she knew he was the man she wanted to marry. As they're shown snoodling in a pool, Jackie describes how open Steve is. How he opens up his heart. And Steve says Jackie is the most giving woman he's ever met in his life. Once they decided to elope, for some reason, the wedding had to be on a fast track, and so Steve tells us that it took them about 3 hours to do what it takes other people 3 months to do. And that's 6 months in 2015 time. It took Jackie a minute and a half to find her wedding dress. They perform for the camera, reenacting scenes of getting ready for their wedding, getting married, honeymooning in Mexico, where they danced at the disco until 3 a.m. Steve says, "It works because we talk. It works because we have the same wants." And Jackie says, "It's wonderful to have a lover and a best friend and a pal and a roommate and a playmate." Steve says, "We really took the time to make sure that this was right." And Jackie and Steve were married for 1 year, from 1985 until 1986. But there is one other Jackie Zeman Meets Lifestyle video online that is a true delight. It's a video tribute that someone made. It's taken from a segment that aired in 1986 after her divorce from Steve, when she wanted to promote her beauty and exercise book. It's called Beauty on the Run. And there's no narration to this, just the Lifestyles music. And imagine Bobby from General Hospital performing an endless round of aerobics and stretches in the hot sun on the deck of a yacht in Portofino, Italy. Most of the shots are designed to showcase just how trim she is and how much she's trimmed her bikini line and how tight her ass is. Hey, it's pretty tight. I'm not going to deny it. At one point, she dives into the water to cool off and then gets out and does some more exercising. It's a random video, the kind of thing you find only if you're a lifestyles freak or a Jackie Zeman freak. But it encapsulates everything about lifestyles I could ever want to say, more than all the words I just strung together on this episode. Watching her do all those leg lifts and bends and stretches on the yacht in the sun is just so 80s and so lifestyles. It's 3.5 minutes of perfection. You can check it out for yourself on my blog, the Not Shallow blog, notshallow.org. Although I gotta say that there's an image at the end that might not be safe for work. It's pretty weird. It's kind of over-the-top, sexy Jackie Zeman. And it's not something you maybe want your boss or coworker to see you looking at, if only because then you gotta explain maybe why you're watching a Jackie Zeman video tribute. It's made from an old Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous segment. Anyway, I'll post it to the blog and on my Facebook page, along with the rant from Mike Love during the Beach Boys induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And just a side note that I'm also on Twitter, and I'm always looking for buddies on Twitter. My handle is, what else? Not at, not shallow. So check me out there if you're on Twitter, and let's connect. Until next time, champagne wishes and caviar dreams.